half-guilty, those quarter-guilty, and those who had hung out their footcloth to dry on the same branch as the Germans. After all, even 1% of just 1 million fills up a dozen full-blooded camps. And dismiss the thought that honourable participation in an underground anti-German organisation would surely protect one from being arrested in this way. More than one case proved this. For instance, there was the Kiev Komsomol member whom the underground organisation sent to serve in the Kiev police during the German occupation in order to obtain inside information. The boy kept the Komsomol honestly informed about everything, but when our forces arrived on the scene, he got his tenor, because he couldn't, while serving in the police, fail to acquire some of the enemy's spirit or to carry out some enemy orders. Those who were in Europe got the stiffest punishments of all, even though they went there as conscripted German slaves. That was because they had seen something of European life and could talk about it. And their stories, which made unpleasant listening for us, except, of course, for the travel notes of sensible writers, were especially unpleasant during the post-war years of ruin and disorganization. Not everyone, after all, was able to report that things in Europe were hopelessly bad and that it was absolutely impossible to live there. That also was the reason why they sentenced the majority of war prisoners. It was not simply because they had allowed themselves to be captured, particularly those POWs who had seen a little more of the West than a German death camp. That was not such a clear-cut decision at the start. Even in 1943, there were certain separate waves which were like no others, like the so-called Africans, who bore this nickname for a long time at the Vorkuta construction projects. These were Russian war prisoners of the Germans, who had been taken prisoner a second time when the Americans captured them from Rommel's army in Africa, the Hiwi. In 1943, they were sent in Studebakers through Egypt, Iraq, and Iran to their motherland, and on a desert gulf of the Caspian they were immediately put behind barbed wire. The police who received them ripped off their military insignia and liberated them of all things the Americans had given them, keeping them for themselves, of course, not turning them over to the state. Then they sent them off to Vorkuta to await special orders without, due to inexperience, sentencing them to a specific term under any article of the code. These Africans lived in Vorkuta in a betwixt-and-between condition. They were not under guard, but they were given no passes, and without passes they could not take so much as one step in Vorkuta. They were paid wages at the same rate as free workers, but they were treated like prisoners. And the special orders never did come. They were forgotten men. This was obvious from the fact that interned persons were sentenced as severely as POWs. For example, during the first days of the war, one of our destroyers went aground on Swedish territory. Its crew proceeded to live freely in Sweden during all the rest of the war, and in such comfort and plenty as they had never experienced before and would never experience again. The USSR retreated, attacked, starved, and died, while those scoundrels stuffed their neutral mugs. After the war, Sweden returned them to us along with the destroyer. Their treason to the motherland was indubitable, but somehow the case didn't get off the ground. They let them go their different ways and then pasted them with anti-Soviet agitation for their lovely stories in praise of freedom and good eating in capitalist Sweden. This was the Kadenko group. What happened to this group later makes an anecdote. In camp they kept their mouths shut about Sweden, fearing they'd get a second term. But people in Sweden somehow found out about their fate and published slanderous reports in the press. By that time, the boys were scattered far and near among various camps. Suddenly, on the strength of special orders, they were all yanked out and taken to the Kresty prison in Leningrad. There they were fed for 2 months, as though for slaughter, and allowed to let their hair grow. Then they were dressed with modest elegance, rehearsed on what to say and to whom, and warned that any bastard who dared to squeak out of turn would get a bullet in his skull. And they were led off to a press conference for selected foreign journalists and some others who had known the entire crew in Sweden. The former internees bore themselves cheerfully, described where they were living, studying, and working, and expressed their indignation at the bourgeois slander they had read about not long before in the Western press. After all, Western papers are sold in the Soviet Union, at every corner newsstand. And so they had written to one another and decided to gather in Leningrad. Their travel expenses didn't bother them in the least. Their fresh, shiny appearance completely gave the lie to the newspaper canard. The discredited journalists went off to write their apologies. It was wholly inconceivable to the Western imagination that there could be any other explanation. And the men who had been the subjects of the interview were taken off to a bath, had their hair cut off again, were dressed in their former rags, and sent back to the same camps. But because they had conducted themselves properly, none of them was given a second term. Within the overall wave of those from formerly occupied areas, there followed, one after another, the quick and compact waves of the nationalities which had transgressed. In 1943, the Kalmyks, Chechens, Ingush, and Balkars. In 1944, the Crimean Tatars. They would not have been pushed out into eternal exile so energetically and swiftly had it not been that regular army units and military trucks were assigned to help the organs. The military units gallantly surrounded the owls, or settlements, and within 24 hours, with the speed of a parachute attack, those who had nested there for centuries past found themselves removed to railroad stations, loaded by the trainload, and rushed off to Siberia, Kazakhstan, Central Asia, and the Russian North. Within one day, their land and their property had been turned over to their heirs. What had happened to the Germans at the beginning of the war now happened to these nationalities. They were exiled solely on the basis of blood. There was no filling out of questionnaires. Party members, heroes of labor, and heroes of the still unfinished war were all sent along with the rest. During the last years of the war, of course, there was a wave of German war criminals who were selected from the POW camps and transferred by court verdict to the jurisdiction of Gulag. In 1945, even though the war with Japan didn't last 3 weeks, great numbers of Japanese war prisoners were raked in for urgent construction projects in Siberia and Central Asia, and the same process of selecting war criminals for Gulag was carried out among them. Without knowing the details, I am nevertheless convinced that a great many of these Japanese could not have been sentenced legitimately. It was an act of revenge, as well as a means of holding on to manpower for as long a period as possible. At the end of 1944, when our army entered the Balkans, and especially in 1945, when it reached into Central Europe, a wave of Russian émigrés flowed through the channels of Gulag. Most were old men who had left at the time of the revolution, but there were also young people who had grown up outside Russia. They usually dragged off the menfolk and left the women and children where they were. It is true that they did not take everyone, but they took all those who, in the course of 25 years, had expressed even the mildest political views, or who had expressed them earlier during the revolution. They did not touch those who had lived a purely vegetable existence. The main waves came from Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. There were fewer from Austria and Germany. In the other countries of Eastern Europe, there were hardly any Russians. As if in response to 1945, a wave of émigrés poured from Manchuria, too. Some of them were not arrested immediately. Entire families were encouraged to return to the homeland as free persons, but once back in Russia they were separated and sent into exile or taken to prison. All during 1945 and 1946, a big wave of genuine, at long last, enemies of the Soviet government flowed into the archipelago. These were the Vlasov men, the Krasnov Cossacks, and Muslims from the national units created under Hitler. Some of them had acted out of conviction, others had been merely involuntary participants. Along with them were seized not less than 1 million fugitives from the Soviet government, civilians of all ages and of both sexes, who had been fortunate enough to find shelter on Allied territory, but who in 1946 to 1947 were perfidiously returned by Allied authorities into Soviet hands. It is surprising that in the West, where political secrets cannot be kept long, since they inevitably come out in print or are disclosed, the secret of this particular act of betrayal has been very well and carefully kept by the British and American governments. This is truly the last secret, or one of the last, of the Second World War. Having often encountered these people in camps, I was unable to believe for a whole quarter century that the public in the West knew nothing of this action of the Western governments, this massive handing over of ordinary Russian people to retribution and death. Not until 1973, in the Sunday Oklahoman of January the 21st, was an article by Julius Epstein published. And I am here going to be so bold as to express gratitude on behalf of the mass of those who perished and those few left alive. One random little document was published from the many volumes of the hitherto concealed case history of forced repatriation to the Soviet Union. After having remained unmolested in British hands for 2 years, they had allowed themselves to be lulled into a false sense of security, and they were therefore taken completely by surprise. They did not realize they were being repatriated. They were mainly simple peasants with bitter personal grievances against the Bolsheviks. The English authorities gave them the treatment reserved in the case of every other nation for war criminals alone, that of being handed over against their will to captors who, incidentally, were not expected to give them a fair trial. They were all sent to destruction on the archipelago. Author's note, dated 1973. A certain number of Poles, members of the Home Army, followers of Mikołajczyk, arrived in Gulag in 1945 via our prisons. There were a certain number of Romanians and Hungarians. At war's end, and for many years after, there flowed uninterruptedly an abundant wave of Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderovtsi. Against the background of this enormous post-war displacement of millions, few paid much attention to such small waves as foreigners' girlfriends in 1946 to 1947. In other words, Soviet girls who went out with foreigners. They sentenced these girls under Article 735 SOE, socially dangerous element. Spanish children, the same children who had been taken from their homeland during the Spanish Civil War, but who were adults by the end of World War II. Raised in our boarding schools, they nonetheless fitted very poorly into our life. Many longed to go home. They, too, were given 735 SOE, socially dangerous element. And those who were particularly stubborn got 58-6, espionage on behalf of America. In fairness, we must not forget the brief reverse wave of priests in 1947. Yes, a miracle. For the first time in 30 years, they freed priests. They didn't actually go about seeking them out in camps. But whenever a priest was known to people in freedom, and whenever a name and exact location could be provided, the individual priests in question were sent out to freedom in order to strengthen the church, which at that time was being revived. We have to remind our readers once again that this chapter does not attempt by any means to list all the waves which fertilized Gulag, but only those which had a political coloration. And just as, in a course in physiology, after a detailed description of the circulation of the blood, one can begin over again and describe in detail the lymphatic system, one could begin again and describe the waves of non-political offenders and habitual criminals from 1918 to 1953. And this description, too, would run long. It would bring to light many famous decrees, now in part forgotten, even though they have never been repealed, which supplied abundant human material for the insatiable archipelago. One was the decree on absenteeism. One was the decree on production of bad quality goods. Another was on samogon, moonshine, distilling. Its peak period was 1922, but arrests for this were constant throughout the 20s. And the decree on the punishment of collective farmers for failure to fulfill the obligatory norm of labor days. And the decree on the introduction of military discipline on railroads, issued in April 1943, not at the beginning of the war, but when it had already taken a turn for the better. In accordance with the ancient Petrine tradition, these decrees always put in an appearance as the most important element in all our legislation, but without any comprehension of or reference to the whole of our previous legislation. Learned jurists were supposed to coordinate the branches of the law, but they were not particularly energetic at it, nor particularly successful, either. This steady pulse of decrees led to a curious national pattern of violations and crimes. One could easily recognize that neither burglary, nor murder, nor samagon distilling, nor rape ever seemed to occur at random intervals or in random places throughout the country as a result of human weakness, lust, or failure to control one's passions. By no means. One detected instead a surprising unanimity and monotony in the crimes committed. The entire Soviet Union would be in a turmoil of rape alone, or murder alone, or samagon distilling alone, each in its turn, insensitive reaction to the latest government decree. Each particular crime or violation seemed somehow to be playing into the hands of the latest decree, so that it would disappear from the scene that much faster. At that precise moment, the particular crime which had just been foreseen, and for which wise new legislation had just provided stricter punishment, would explode simultaneously everywhere. The decree on the militarization of railroads crowded the military tribunals with the women and adolescents who did most of the work on the railroads during the war years, and who, having received no barracks training beforehand, were those mostly involved in delays and violations. The decree on failure to fulfill the obligatory norm of labor days greatly simplified the procedure for removing from the scene those collective farmers who were dissatisfied with receiving for their labor mere labor day points in the farm account books, and wanted produce instead. Whereas previously their cases had required a trial, based on the article of the code relating to economic counter-revolution, now it was enough to produce a collective farm decree confirmed by the district executive committee. And even then, these collective farmers, although they were sent into exile, must have been relieved to know that they were not listed as enemies of the people. The obligatory norm of labor days was different in different areas, the easiest of all being among the peoples of the Caucasus, 75 labor days a year. But despite that, many of them were also sent off to Krasnoyarsk province for 8 years. As we have said, we are not going to go into a lengthy and lavish examination of the waves of non-political offenders and common criminals. But having reached 1947, we cannot remain silent about one of the most grandiose of Stalin's decrees. We have already mentioned the famous law of 7-8, or 7/8, on the basis of which they arrested people right and left for taking a stalk of grain, a cucumber, 2 small potatoes, a chip of wood, a spool of thread, all of whom got 10 years. In the actual documents of the spool of thread case, they wrote down 200 meters of sewing material. The fact remains that they were ashamed to write a spool of thread. But the requirements of the times, as Stalin understood them, had changed, and the tenor, which had seemed adequate on the eve of a terrible war, seemed now, in the wake of a worldwide historical victory, inadequate. And so again, in complete disregard of the code, and totally overlooking the fact that many different articles and decrees on the subject of thefts and robberies already existed, on June the 4th, 1947, a decree was issued which outdid them all. It was instantly christened 4/6 by the undismayed prisoners. The advantages of the new decree lay first of all in its newness. From the very moment it appeared, a torrent of the crimes it specified would be bound to burst forth, thereby providing an abundant wave of newly sentenced prisoners. But it offered an even greater advantage in prison terms. If a young girl sent into the fields to get a few ears of grain took along 2 friends for company, an organized gang, or some 12-year-old youngsters went after cucumbers or apples, they were liable to get 20 years in camp. In factories, the maximum sentence was raised to 25 years. This sentence, called the quarter, had been introduced a few days earlier to replace the death penalty, which had been abolished as a humane act. And the death penalty itself was kept veiled for a brief period only. The veil was removed, amid a show of bared fangs, 2.5 years later, in January 1950. And then, at long last, an ancient shortcoming of the law was corrected. Previously, the only failure to make a denunciation which qualified as a crime against the state had been in connection with political offences. But now, simple failure to report the theft of state or collective farm property earned 3 years of camp or 7 years of exile. In the years immediately following this decree, whole divisions from the countryside and the cities were sent off to cultivate the islands of Gulag in place of the natives who had died off there. True, these waves were processed through the police and the ordinary courts and did not clog the channels of state security, which, even without them, were overstrained in the post-war years. Stalin's new line, suggesting that it was necessary, in the wake of the victory over fascism, to jail more people more energetically and for longer terms than ever before, had immediate repercussions, of course, on political prisoners. The year 1948 to 1949, notable throughout Soviet public life for intensified persecution and vigilance, was marked by one tragicomedy hitherto unheard of even in Stalinist anti-justice, that of the repeaters. That is what, in the language of Gulag, they called those still undestroyed unfortunates of 1937 vintage, who had succeeded in surviving 10 impossible, unendurable years, and who in 1947 to 1948 had timidly stepped forth onto the land of freedom. Worn out, broken in health, but hoping to live out in peace what little of their lives remained. But some sort of savage fantasy, or stubborn malice, or unsated vengeance, pushed the victorious Generalissimo into issuing the new order to arrest all those cripples over again, without any new charges. It was even disadvantageous, both economically and politically, to clog the meat grinder with its own refuse. But Stalin issued the order anyway. Here was a case in which a historical personality simply behaved capriciously toward historical necessity. And so it was necessary to take all of them, though they had hardly had a chance to attach themselves to new places or new families. They were rounded up with much the same weary indolence they themselves now returned with. They knew beforehand the whole way of the cross ahead. They did not ask what for, and they did not say to their families, "I'll be back." They put on their shabbiest rags, poured some makorka into their camp tobacco pouches, and went off to sign the deposition. Only one question. "Are you the one who was in prison?" "Yes." "Take 10 more." At this point, the autocrat decided it wasn't enough to arrest just those who had survived since 1937. What about the children of his sworn enemies? They, too, must be imprisoned. They were growing up, and they might have notions of vengeance. He may have had a heavy dinner and had a nightmare about those children. They went through the lists, looked around, and arrested children, but not very many. They arrested the children of the purged army commanders, but not all the children of Trotskyites. And so the wave of the vengeful children came into being. Among such children were 17-year-old Lena Kozarieva and 35-year-old Yelena Ravokskaya. By 1948, after the great European displacement, Stalin had succeeded once again in tightly barricading himself in and pulling the ceiling down closer to him. In this reduced space, he had recreated the tension of 1937. And so, in 1948, 1949, and 1950, there flowed past alleged spies. 10 years earlier, they had been German and Japanese. Now they were Anglo-American. Believers, this wave non-orthodox for the most part. Those geneticists and plant breeders, disciples of the late Vavilov and of Mendel, who had not previously been arrested. Just plain, ordinary thinking people, and students with particular severity, who had not been sufficiently scared away from the West. It was fashionable to charge them with VAT, praise of American technology, VAD, praise of American democracy, and PZ, toadyism toward the West. These waves were not unlike those of 1937, but the sentences were different. The standard sentence was no longer the patriarchal 10-ruble bill, but the new Stalinist 25. By now, the tenor was for juveniles. There was a good-sized wave from the new decree on revealing state secrets. State secrets included such things as the district harvest, any figure on epidemics, the type of goods produced by any workshop or mini-factory, mention of a civil airport, municipal transport routes, or the family name of any prisoner imprisoned in any camp. For violations of this decree, they gave 15 years. The waves of nationalities were not forgotten either. The Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderovtsi, taken in the heat of struggle from the forests where they fought, kept flowing all this time. Simultaneously, all West Ukrainian country people received tenors and fivers in camps and exile, presumably for having had connections with the partisans. Someone had let them spend the night. Someone had once fed them. Someone had not reported them. For about a year, starting in 1950, a wave of wives of Banderovtsi was underway. They gave them each 10 years for failure to make a denunciation, so as to finish off their husbands faster. By this time, resistance in Lithuania and Estonia had already come to an end, but in 1949, new waves of new social prophylaxis to assure collectivization kept coming. They took whole trainloads of city dwellers and peasants from the three Baltic republics into Siberian exile. The historical rhythm was disrupted in these republics. They were forced to recapitulate in brief, limited periods the more extended experience of the rest of the country. In 1948, one more nationalist wave went into exile, that of the Greeks who inhabited the areas around the Sea of Azov, the Kuban, and Tsukumi. They had done nothing to offend the father during the war, but now he avenged himself on them for his failure in Greece, or so it seemed. This wave, too, was evidently the fruit of his personal insanity. The majority of the Greeks ended up in Central Asian exile. Those who voiced their discontent were thrown into political prisons. Around 1950, to avenge the same lost war, or perhaps just to balance those already in exile, the Greek rebels from Marcos's army, who had been turned over to us by Bulgaria, were themselves shipped off to the archipelago. During the last years of Stalin's life, a wave of Jews became noticeable. From 1950 on, they were hauled in, little by little, as cosmopolites, and that was why the doctor's case was cooked up. It would appear that Stalin intended to arrange a great massacre of the Jews. It has always been impossible to learn the truth about anything in our country, now and always and from the beginning. But according to Moscow rumors, Stalin's plan was this. At the beginning of March, the doctor murderers were to be hanged on Red Square. The aroused patriots, spurred on naturally by instructors, were to rush into an anti-Jewish pogrom. At this point, the government, and here Stalin's character can be divined, can it not, would intervene generously to save the Jews from the wrath of the people, and that same night would remove them from Moscow to the Far East in Siberia, where barracks had already been prepared for them. But this became the first plan of his life to fail. God told him, apparently with the help of human hands, to depart from his rib cage. The preceding exposition should have made it clear, one would think, that in the removal of millions and in the populating of gulag, consistent, cold-blooded planning and never-weakening persistence were at work. That we never did have any empty prisons, merely prisons which were full or prisons which were very, very overcrowded. And that while you occupied yourself to your heart's content studying the safe secrets of the atomic nucleus, researching the influence of Heidegger on Sartre, or collecting Picasso reproductions, while you rode off in your railroad sleeping compartment to vacation resorts, or finished building your country house near Moscow. The black Mariahs rolled incessantly through the streets, and the gabisti, the state security men, knocked at doors and rang doorbells. And I think this exposition proves that the organs always earned their pay. Chapter 3. The Interrogation. If the intellectuals and the players of Chekhov, who spent all their time guessing what would happen in 20, 30, or 40 years, had been told that in 40 years interrogation by torture would be practiced in Russia, that prisoners would have their skulls squeezed within iron rings, that a human being would be lowered into an acid bath, that they would be trussed up naked to be bitten by ants and bedbugs, that a ramrod heated over a primer stove would be thrust up their anal canal, the secret brand, that a man's genitals would be slowly crushed beneath the toe of a jackboot, and that, in the luckiest possible circumstances, prisoners would be tortured by being kept from sleeping for a week, by thirst, and by being beaten to a bloody pulp. Not one of Chekhov's plays would have gotten to its end, because all the heroes would have gone off to insane asylums. Yes, not only Chekhov's heroes, but what normal Russian at the beginning of the century, including any member of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, could have believed, would have tolerated, such a slander against the bright future. What had been acceptable under Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich in the 17th century, what had already been regarded as barbarism under Peter the Great, what might have been used against 10 or 20 people in all during the time of Biron in the mid-18th century, what had already become totally impossible under Catherine the Great, was all being practiced during the flowering of the glorious 20th century, in a society based on socialist principles, and at a time when airplanes were flying and the radio and talking films had already appeared, not by one scoundrel alone in one secret place only, but by tens of thousands of specially trained human beasts standing over millions of defenseless victims. Was it only that explosion of atavism which is now evasively called the cult of personality that was so horrible? Or was it even more horrible that during those same years, in 1937 itself, we celebrated Pushkin's centennial, and that we shamelessly continued to stage those self-same Chekhov plays, even though the answers to them had already come in? Is it not still more dreadful that we are now being told, 30 years later, don't talk about it? If we start to recall the sufferings of millions, we are told it will distort the historical perspective. If we doggedly seek out the essence of our morality, we are told it will darken our material progress. Let's think rather about the blast furnaces, the rolling mills that were built, the canals that were dug. No, better not talk about the canals. Then maybe about the gold of the Kolyma. No, maybe we ought not to talk about that either. Well, we can talk about anything, so long as we do it adroitly, so long as we glorify it. It is really hard to see why we condemn the Inquisition. Wasn't it true that beside the autos da fe, magnificent services were offered the Almighty? It is hard to see why we are so down on serfdom. After all, no one forbade the peasants to work every day. And they could sing carols at Christmas, too. And for Trinity Day, the girls wove wreaths. The exceptional character which written and oral legend nowadays assigns to the year 1937 is seen in the creation of fabricated charges and tortures. But this is untrue, wrong. Throughout the years and decades, interrogations under Article 58 were almost never undertaken to elicit the truth, but were simply an exercise in an inevitably filthy procedure. Someone who had been free only a little while before, who was sometimes proud and always unprepared, was to be bent and pushed through a narrow pipe where his sides would be torn by iron hooks and where he could not breathe, so that he would finally pray to get to the other end. And at the other end he would be shoved out, an already processed native of the archipelago, already in the promised land. The fool would keep on resisting. He even thought there was a way back out of the pipe. The more time that passes without anything being written about all this, the harder it becomes to assemble the scattered testimony of the survivors. But they tell us that the creation of fabricated cases began back in the early years of the organs, so their constant salutary activity might be perceived as essential. Otherwise, what with the decline in the number of enemies, the organs might, in a bad hour, have been forced to wither away. As the case of Kosirev makes clear, the situation of the Cheka was shaky even at the beginning of 1919. Reading the newspapers of 1918, I ran into the official report of a terrible plot that had just been discovered. A group of 10 people wanted to, it seems they only wanted to, drag cannon onto the roof of an orphanage, let's see how high was it, and shell the Kremlin. There were 10 of them, including perhaps women and youngsters, and it was not reported how many cannon there were to be, nor where the cannon were to come from, nor what caliber they were, nor how they were to be carried up the stairs to the attic, nor how they were to be set up on the steeply sloping roof, and so they wouldn't recoil when fired. How was it that the Petersburg police, when they were fighting to put down the February Revolution, took nothing heavier than a machine gun up to the roofs? Yet this fantasy, exceeding even the fabrications of 1937, was read and believed. Apparently it will prove to us in time that the Gumilev case of 1921 was also fabricated. A.A. Akhmatova told me she was convinced that this was so. She even gave me the name of the Czechist who cooked up the case. Y. Agranov, it seems. In that same year, 1921, the Ryazan Cheka fabricated a false case of a plot on the part of the local intelligentsia. But the protests of courageous people could still reach Moscow, and they dropped the case. That year, too, the whole Saprepolite committee, part of the Commission on the Use of Natural Forces, was shot. Familiar enough with the attitude and the mood of Russian scientists at that time, and not being shut off from those years by a smokescreen of fanaticism, we can indeed figure out, even without archaeological excavations, the precise validity of that case. Here is what Y. Doyarenko remembers about 1921. The Lubyanka reception cell for those newly arrested, with 40 to 50 trestle beds, and women being brought in one after another all night long. None of them knew what she was supposed to be guilty of, and there was a feeling among them that people were being arrested for no reason at all. Only one woman in the whole cell knew why she was there. She was an SR. The first question asked by Yagoda, "Well, what are you here for?" In other words, you tell me, and help me cook up the case. And they say absolutely the same thing about the Ryazan GPU in 1930. People all felt they were being imprisoned for no reason. There was so little on which to base a charge that they accused IDT blank V of using a false name. And even though his name was perfectly real, they handed him 3 years via a special board, OSO, under 5810. Not knowing what to pick on, the interrogator asked, "What was your job?" Answer, "A planner." The interrogator, "Write me a statement that explains planning at the factory and how it is carried out. After that, I will let you know why you've been arrested." He expected the explanation to provide the hook on which to hang a charge. Here is the way it went in the case of the Kovno Fortress in 1912. Since the fortress served no useful military purpose, it was decided to eliminate it. At that point, the fortress command, thoroughly alarmed, arranged a night attack, simply to prove its usefulness, and in order to stay where they were. The theoretical view of the suspect's guilt was, incidentally, quite elastic from the very beginning. In his instructions on the use of red terror, the Czechist M.I. Latsis wrote, "In the interrogation, do not seek evidence and proof that the person accused acted in word or deed against Soviet power. The first question should be, what is his class? What is his origin? What is his education and upbringing?" There is your Saprepolite committee for you. These are the questions which must determine the fate of the accused. On November the 13th, 1920, Dzerzhinsky reported in a letter to the Cheka that slanderous declarations are often given the green light in the Cheka. After so many decades, have they not taught us that people do not return from there, except for the small, brief, intentional reverse wave of 1939, one hears only the rarest, isolated stories of someone being turned loose as the result of an interrogation. And in such cases, the person was either imprisoned soon again, or else he was let out so he could be kept under surveillance. That is how the tradition arose, that the organs do not make mistakes. Then what about those who were innocent? In his Dictionary of Definitions, Dahl makes the following distinction. An inquiry is distinguished from an investigation by the fact that it is carried out to determine whether there is a basis for proceeding to an investigation. On sacred simplicity, the organs have never heard of such a thing as an inquiry. Lists of names prepared up above, or on initial suspicion, or a denunciation by an informer, or any anonymous denunciation, were all that was needed to bring about the arrest of the suspect followed by the inevitable formal charge. Article 93 of the Code of Criminal Procedure has this to say. An anonymous declaration can serve as reason for beginning a criminal case. And there is no need to be surprised at the word criminal here, since all politicals were considered criminals too, under the code. The time allotted for investigation was not used to unravel the crime, but, in 95 cases out of 100, to exhaust, wear down, weaken, and render helpless the defendant, so that he would want it to end at any cost. As long ago as 1919, the chief method used by the interrogator was a revolver on the desk. That was how they investigated not only political, but also ordinary misdemeanors and violations. At the trial of the Maine Fuels Committee, 1921, the accused, Makrovskaya, complained that at her interrogation she had been drugged with cocaine. The prosecutor replied, if she had declared that she had been treated rudely, that they had threatened to shoot her, this might be just barely believable. The frightening revolver lies there, and sometimes it is aimed at you, and the interrogator doesn't tire himself out thinking up what you are guilty of, but shouts, "Come on, talk, you know what about." That was what the interrogator Kaikin demanded of Shripnikova in 1927. That was what they demanded of Vitkovsky in 1929. And 25 years later, nothing had changed. In 1952, Anna Skripnikova was undergoing her fifth imprisonment, and Sivakov, chief of the investigative department of the Orjonikidze State Security Administration, said to her, "The prison doctor reports you have a blood pressure of 240 over 120. That's too low, you bitch. We're going to drive it up to 340, so you'll kick the bucket, you viper, and with no black and blue marks, no beatings, no broken bones. We'll just not let you sleep." She was in her 50s at the time, and if, back in her cell after a night spent in interrogation, she closed her eyes during the day, the jailer broke in and shouted, "Open your eyes or I'll haul you off that cot by the legs and tie you to the wall standing up." As early as 1921, interrogations usually took place at night. At that time, too, they shone automobile lights in the prisoner's face, the Ryazan checker, Stelmach. And at the Lubyanka in 1926, according to the testimony of Berta Gandal, they made use of the hot air heating system to fill the cell first with icy cold and then with stinking hot air. And there was an airtight cork-lined cell in which there was no ventilation, and they cooked the prisoners. The poet Klyuyev was apparently confined in such a cell, and Berta Gandal also. A participant in the Yaroslavl Uprising of 1918, Vasily Alexandrovich Kazyanov described how the heat in such a cell was turned up until your blood began to ooze through your pores. When they saw this happening through the peephole, they would put the prisoner on a stretcher and take him off to sign his confession. The hot and salty methods of the gold period are well known, and in Georgia in 1926, they used lighted cigarettes to burn the hands of prisoners under interrogation. In Meteki prison, they pushed prisoners into a cesspool in the dark. There is a very simple connection here. Once it was established that charges had to be brought at any cost, and despite everything, threats, violence, tortures became inevitable. And the more fantastic the charges were, the more ferocious the interrogation had to be in order to force the required confession. Given the fact that the cases were always fabricated, violence and torture had to accompany them. This was not peculiar to 1937 alone. It was a chronic, general practice. And that is why it seems strange today to read in the recollections of former Zeks that torture was permitted from the spring of 1938 on. Y. Ginsburg writes that permission for physical measures of persuasion was given in April 1938. V. Shalamov believes that tortures were permitted from the middle of 1938 on. The old prisoner, M. Blank C.H., is convinced that there was an order to simplify the questioning and to change from psychological methods to physical methods. Ivanov Razumnik singles out the middle of 1938 as the period of the most cruel interrogations. There were never any spiritual or moral barriers which could have held the organs back from torture. in the early post-war years, in the Cheka Weekly, the Red Sword, and Red Terror, the admissibility of torture from a Marxist point of view was openly debated. Judging by the subsequent course of events, the answer deduced was positive, though not universally so. It is more accurate to say that if before 1938 some kind of formal documentation was required as a preliminary to torture, as well as specific permission for each case under investigation, even though such permission was easy to obtain, then in the years 1937 to 1938, in view of the extraordinary situation prevailing, the specified millions of admissions to the archipelago had to be ground through the apparatus of individual interrogation in specified limited periods, something which had simply not happened in the mass waves of kulaks and nationalities. Interrogators were allowed to use violence and torture on an unlimited basis, at their own discretion, and in accordance with the demands of their work quotas and the amount of time they were given. The types of torture used were not regulated, and every kind of ingenuity was permitted, no matter what. In 1939, such indiscriminate authorization was withdrawn, and once again written permission was required for torture, and perhaps it may not have been so easily granted. Of course, simple threats, blackmail, deception, exhaustion through enforced sleeplessness, and punishment cells were never prohibited. Then, from the end of the war and throughout the post-war years, certain categories of prisoners were established by decree, for whom a broad range of torture was automatically permitted. Among these were nationalists, particularly the Ukrainians and the Lithuanians, especially in those cases where an underground organization existed, or was suspected, that had to be completely uncovered, which meant obtaining the names of everyone involved from those already arrested. For example, there were about 50 Lithuanians in the group of Romualdas Skyrius, the son of Pranus. In 1945, they were charged with posting anti-Soviet leaflets. Because there weren't enough prisons in Lithuania at the time, they sent them to a camp near Velsk in Archangel province. There, some were tortured, and others simply couldn't endure the double regime of work plus interrogation, with the result that all 50, to the very last one, confessed. After a short time, news came from Lithuania that the real culprits responsible for the leaflets had been discovered, and none of the first group had been involved at all. In 1950, at the Kuibyshev Transit Prison, I encountered a Ukrainian from Dnepropetrovsk who had been tortured many different ways in an effort to squeeze contacts and names out of him. Among the tortures to which he had been subjected was a punishment cell in which there was room only to stand. They shoved a pole inside for him to hold on to so that he could sleep for 4 hours a day. After the war, they tortured corresponding member of the Academy of Sciences, Levina, because she and the Alilyuevs had acquaintances in common. It would also be incorrect to ascribe to 1937 the discovery that the personal confession of an accused person was more important than any other kind of proof or facts. This concept had already been formulated in the 20s. And 1937 was just the year when the brilliant teaching of Vyshinsky came into its own. Incidentally, even at that time, his teaching was transmitted only to interrogators and prosecutors for the sake of their morale and steadfastness. The rest of us only learned about it 20 years later, when it had already come into disfavor, through subordinate clauses and minor paragraphs of newspaper articles, which treated the subject as if it had long been widely known to all. It turns out that in that terrible year, Andrei Yanurevich, one longs to blurt out Jaguarevich Vyshinsky, availing himself of the most flexible dialectics, of a sort nowadays not permitted either Soviet citizens or electronic calculators, since to them yes is yes and no is no, pointed out in a report, which became famous in certain circles, that it is never possible for mortal men to establish absolute truth, but relative truth only. He then proceeded to a further step, which jurists of the last 2,000 years had not been willing to take, that the truth established by interrogation and trial could not be absolute, but only, so to speak, relative. Therefore, when we sign a sentence ordering someone to be shot, we can never be absolutely certain, but only approximately, in view of certain hypotheses, and in a certain sense, that we are punishing a guilty person. Perhaps Vyshinsky, no less than his listeners, needed this ideological comfort at this time, when he cried out from the prosecutor's platform, "Shoot them all like mad dogs!" He, at least, who was both evil and quick of mind, understood that the accused were innocent. And in all probability, he and that whale of Marxist dialectics, the defendant Bukharin, devoted themselves with all the greater passion to the dialectical elaboration of the judicial lie. For Bukharin, it was too stupid and futile to die if he was altogether innocent. Thus he needed to find his own guilt. And for Vyshinsky, it was more agreeable to see himself as a logician than as a plain, downright scoundrel. Thence arose the most practical conclusion, that it was useless to seek absolute evidence, for evidence is always relative, or unchallengeable witnesses, for they can say different things at different times. The proofs of guilt were relative, approximate, and the interrogator could find them, even when there was no evidence and no witness, without leaving his office, basing his conclusions not only on his own intellect, but also on his party sensitivity, his moral forces. In other words, the superiority of someone who has slept well, had been well fed, and has not been beaten up. And on his character, that is, his willingness to apply cruelty. Of course, this formulation was much more elegant than Latsis's instructions, but the essence of both was the same. In only one respect did Vyshinsky fail to be consistent and retreat from dialectical logic. For some reason, the executioner's bullet, which he allowed, was not relative, but absolute. Thus it was that the conclusions of advanced Soviet jurisprudence, proceeding in a spiral, returned to barbaric or medieval standards. Like medieval torturers, our interrogators, prosecutors, and judges agreed to accept the confession of the accused as the chief proof of guilt. Compare the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Not be compelled. The same thing appears in the 17th century Bill of Rights. However, the simple-minded Middle Ages used dramatic and picturesque methods to squeeze out the desired confessions, the rack, the wheel, the bed of nails, impalement, hot coals, etc. In the 20th century, taking advantage of our more highly developed medical knowledge and extensive prison experience, and someone seriously defended a doctoral dissertation on this theme, people came to realize that the accumulation of such impressive apparatus was superfluous, and that, on a mass scale, it was also cumbersome. And, in addition, there was evidently one other circumstance. As always, Stalin did not pronounce that final word, and his subordinates had to guess what he wanted. Thus, like a jackal, he left himself an escape hole, so that he could, if he wanted, beat a retreat and write about dizziness from success. After all, for the first time in human history, the calculated torture of millions was being undertaken, and even with all his strength and power, Stalin could not be absolutely sure of success. In dealing with such an enormous mass of material, the effects of the experiment might differ from those obtained from a smaller sample. An unforeseen explosion might take place, a slippage and a geological fault, or even worldwide disclosure. In any case, Stalin had to remain innocent, his sacred vestments angelically pure. We are therefore forced to conclude that no list of tortures and torments existed in printed form for the guidance of interrogators. Instead, all that was required was for every interrogation department to supply the tribunal within a specified period with a stipulated number of rabbits who had confessed everything. And it was simply stated, orally but often, that any measures and means employed were good, since they were being used for a lofty purpose, that no interrogator would be made to answer for the death of an accused, and that the prison doctor should interfere as little as possible with the course of the investigation. In all probability, they exchanged experiences in comradely fashion. They learned from the most successful workers. Then, too, material rewards were offered, higher pay for night work, bonus pay for fast work, And there were also definite warnings that interrogators who could not cope with their tasks, even the chief of some provincial NKVD administration, if some sort of mess developed, could show Stalin his hands were clean. He had issued no direct instructions to use torture, but at the same time he had ensured that torture would be used. Understanding that their superiors were taking precautions for self-protection, some of the rank-and-file interrogators, not, however, those who drank like maniacs, tried to start off with milder methods, and even when they intensified them, they tried to avoid those that left obvious marks, an eye gouged out, an ear torn off, a backbone broken, even bruises all over the body. That is why in 1937 we observe no general consistency of methods, except for enforced sleeplessness, in the administrations of the various provinces, or for that matter among the different interrogators of a single administration. It is common talk that Rostov-on-the-Don and Krasnodar were particularly distinguished for the cruelty of their tortures, but this has not been proved. What they did have in common, however, was that they gave precedence to the so-called light methods. We will see what they were immediately. This way was sure. Indeed, the actual boundaries of human equilibrium are very narrow, and it is not really necessary to use a rack or hot coals to drive the average human being out of his mind. Let us try to list some of the simplest methods which break the will and the character of the prisoner without leaving marks on his body. Let us begin with psychological methods. These methods have enormous and even annihilating impact on rabbits who have never been prepared for prison suffering. And it isn't easy even for a person who holds strong convictions. 1. First of all, night. Why is it that all the main work of breaking down human souls went on at night? Why, from their very earliest years, did the organs select the night? Because at night the prisoner, torn from sleep, even though he has not yet been tortured by sleeplessness, lacks his normal daytime equanimity and common sense. He is more vulnerable. 2. Persuasion, in a sincere tone, is the very simplest method. Why play at cat and mouse, so to speak? After all, having spent some time among others undergoing interrogation, the prisoner has come to see what the situation is. And so the interrogator says to him in a lazily friendly way, "Look, you're going to get a prison term, whatever happens. But if you resist, you'll croak right here in prison. You'll lose your health. But if you go to camp, you'll have fresh air and sunlight. So why not sign right now?" Very logical. And those who agree and sign are smart if the matter concerns only themselves. But that's rarely so. A struggle is inevitable. Another variant of persuasion is particularly appropriate to the party member. If there are shortages and even famine in the country, then you as a Bolshevik have to make up your mind. Can you admit that the whole party is to blame, or the whole Soviet government? "No, of course not," the director of the flax depot hastened to reply. "Then be brave and shoulder the blame yourself." And he did. 3. Foul language is not a clever method, but it can have a powerful impact on people who are well brought up, refined, delicate. I know of two cases involving priests who capitulated to foul language alone. One of them, in the Butyrki in 1944, was being interrogated by a woman. At first, when he'd come back to our cell, he couldn't say often enough how polite she was. But once he came back very despondent, and for a long time he refused to tell us how, with her legs crossed high, she had begun to curse. I regret that I cannot cite one of her little phrases here. 4. Psychological contrast was sometimes effective. Sudden reversals of tone, for example. For a whole or part of the interrogation period, the interrogator would be extremely friendly, addressing the prisoner formally by first name and patronymic, and promising everything. Suddenly, he would brandish a paperweight and shout, "Fool, you rat! I'll put 9 grams of lead in your skull!" And he would advance on the accused, clutching hands outstretched, as if to grab him by the hair, fingernails like needles. This worked very, very well with women prisoners. Or as a variation on this, two interrogators would take turns. One would shout and bully. The other would be friendly, almost gentle. Each time the accused entered the office, he would tremble. Which would it be? He wanted to do everything to please the gentle one because of his different manner, even to the point of signing and confessing to things that had never happened. 5. Preliminary humiliation was another approach. In the famous cellars of the Rostov-on-the-Don GPU, House 33, which were lit by lens-like insets of thick glass in the sidewalk above the former storage basement, prisoners awaiting interrogation were made to lie face down for several hours in the main corridor and forbidden to raise their heads or make a sound. They lay this way, like Muslims at prayer, until the guard touched a shoulder and took them off to interrogation. Another case. At the Lubyanka, Alexandra O. blank VA refused to give the testimony demanded of her. She was transferred to Lefortovo. In the admitting office, a woman jailer ordered her to undress, allegedly for a medical examination, took away her clothes, and locked her in a box, naked. At that point, the men jailers began to peer through the peephole and to appraise her female attributes with loud laughs. If one were systematically to question former prisoners, many more such examples would certainly emerge. They all had but a single purpose, to dishearten and humiliate. 6. Any method of inducing extreme confusion in the accused might be employed. Here is how FIV from Krasnogorsk, Moscow province, was interrogated. This was reported by IAP blank EV. During the interrogation, the interrogator, a woman, undressed in front of him by stages, a striptease, all the time continuing the interrogation as if nothing were going on. She walked about the room and came close to him, and tried to get him to give in. Perhaps this satisfied some personal quirk in her, but it may also have been cold-blooded calculation, an attempt to get the accused so muddled that he would sign. And she was in no danger. She had her pistol, and she had her alarm bell. 7. Intimidation was very widely used and very varied. It was often accompanied by enticement and by promises which were, of course, false. In 1924, "If you don't confess, you'll go to the Solovetsky Islands. Anybody who confesses is turned loose." In 1944, "Which camp you'll be sent to depends on us. Camps are different. We've got hard labor camps now. If you confess, you'll go to an easy camp. If you're stubborn, you'll get 25 years in handcuffs in the mines." Another form of intimidation was threatening a prisoner with a prison worse than the one he was in. "If you keep on being stubborn, we'll send you to Lefortovo, if you are in the Lubyanka, to Sukhanovka, if you are at Lefortovo. They'll find another way to talk to you there." You have already gotten used to things where you are. The regimen seems to be not so bad. And what kind of torments await you elsewhere? Yes, and you also have to be transported there. Should you give in? Intimidation worked beautifully on those who had not yet been arrested, but had simply received an official summons to the Bolshoi Dom, the big house. He, or she, still had a lot to lose. He, or she, was frightened of everything, that they wouldn't let him or her out today, that they would confiscate his or her belongings or apartment. He would be ready to give all kinds of testimony and make all kinds of concessions in order to avoid these dangers. She, of course, would be ignorant of the criminal code, and at the very least, at the start of the questioning, they would push a sheet of paper in front of her with a fake citation from the code. "I have been warned that for giving false testimony, 5 years of imprisonment." In actual fact, under Article 95, it is 2 years. "For refusal to give testimony, 5 years. In actual fact, under Article 92, it is up to 3 months. Here, then, one more of the interrogator's basic methods has entered the picture, and will continue to re-enter it. 8. The lie. We lambs were forbidden to lie, but the interrogator could tell all the lies he felt like. Those articles of the law did not apply to him. We had even lost the yardstick with which to gauge. What does he get for lying? He could confront us with as many documents as he chose, bearing the forged signatures of our kinfolk and friends, and it would be just a skillful interrogation technique. Intimidation through enticement and lies was the fundamental method for bringing pressure on the relatives of the arrested person when they were called in to give testimony. "If you don't tell us such and such," whatever was being asked, "it's going to be the worse for him. You'll be destroying him completely." How hard for a mother to hear that. Under the harsh laws of the Tsarist Empire, close relatives could refuse to testify. And even if they gave testimony at a preliminary investigation, they could choose to repudiate it and refuse to permit it to be used in court. And curiously enough, kinship or acquaintance with a criminal was never in itself considered evidence. "Signing this paper," pushed in front of the relatives, "is the only way you can save him. Destroy him." 9. Playing on one's affection for those one loved was a game that worked beautifully on the accused as well. It was the most effective of all methods of intimidation. One could break even a totally fearless person through his concern for those he loved. Oh, how foresighted was the saying, "A man's family are his enemies." Remember the Tatar who bore all his sufferings, his own and those of his wife, but could not endure his daughters. In 1930, Rimalis, a woman interrogator, used to threaten, "We'll arrest your daughter and lock her in a cell with syphilitics." And that was a woman. They would threaten to arrest everyone you loved. Sometimes this would be done with sound effects. "Your wife has already been arrested, but her further fate depends on you. They are questioning her in the next room. Just listen." And through the wall you can actually hear a woman weeping and screaming. After all, they all sound alike. You're hearing it through a wall, and you're under terrific strain and not in a state to play the expert on voice identification. Sometimes they simply play a recording of the voice of a typical wife, soprano or contralto, a labor-saving device suggested by some inventive genius. And then, without fakery, they actually show her to you through a glass door as she walks along in silence, her head bent in grief. Yes, your own wife in the corridors of state security. You have destroyed her by your stubbornness. She has already been arrested. In actual fact, she has simply been summoned in connection with some insignificant procedural question and sent into the corridor at just the right moment after being told, "Don't raise your head or you'll be kept here." Or they give you a letter to read, and the handwriting is exactly like hers. "I renounce you. After the filth they have told me about you, I don't need you any more." And since such wives do exist in our country, and such letters as well, you are left to ponder in your heart, is that the kind of wife she really is? The interrogator Goldman, in 1944, was trying to extort testimony against other people from V.A. Korneyeva with the threat, "We'll confiscate your house and toss your old women into the street." A woman of deep convictions and firm in her faith, Korneyeva had no fear whatever for herself. She was prepared to suffer. But given our laws, Goldman's threats were all too real, and she was in torment over the fate of her loved ones. When, by morning, after a night of tearing up rejected depositions, Goldman began to write a fourth version accusing Korneyeva alone, she signed it happily and with a feeling of spiritual victory. We fail to hang on to the basic human instinct to prove our innocence when falsely accused. How can we there? We were even glad when we succeeded in taking all the guilt on our own shoulders. Today, she says, after 11 years during rehabilitation proceedings, they let me reread those depositions, and I was gripped by a feeling of spiritual nausea. What was there to be proud of? I myself, during the rehabilitation period, felt the very same way on hearing excerpts from my earlier depositions. As the saying goes, they bent me into a bow, and I became someone else. I did not recognize myself. How could I have signed them and still think I had not gotten off too badly? Just as there is no classification in nature with rigid boundaries, it is impossible rigidly to separate psychological methods from physical ones. Where, for example, should we classify the following amusement? 10. sound effects. The accused is made to stand 20 to 25 feet away and is then forced to speak more and more loudly and to repeat everything. This is not easy for someone already weakened to the point of exhaustion. Or two megaphones are constructed of rolled-up cardboard, and two interrogators coming close to the prisoner bellow in both ears, "Confess, you rat!" The prisoner is deafened. Sometimes he actually loses his sense of hearing. But this method is uneconomical. The fact is that the interrogators like some diversion in their monotonous work, and so they vie in thinking up new ideas. 11. Tickling. This is also a diversion. The prisoner's arms and legs are bound or held down, and then the inside of his nose is tickled with a feather. The prisoner writhes. It feels as though someone were drilling into his brain. 12. A cigarette is put out on the accused's skin, already mentioned above. 13. Light effects.